Dr. Paul Brand is a famous missionary to India. His research and his work on leprosy changed the world. His findings, his effort, his energy, his sacrifice radically changed the perception of leprosy in the medical community and in the general populace as a whole. The reason that one of his great discoveries was dealing with pain, and he learned it from an individual that he had early on in his ministry performed surgery on. His name was Sudan. Sudan had horribly deformed hands and arms, and so Dr. Brand had worked on his hands and had been able to scrape away some of the disease of leprosy, had been able to reconstruct the fingers and had all kinds of surgery, that application done to his arms, and everything was right, and Sudan would go back to his home, and Sudan went back to the village. He's all excited. Not only has he been reconstructed physically, but he's been reconstructed in his heart. He came to know Jesus Christ as Savior. His world was radically changed by Dr. Paul Brand. So he's in the missionary. As a missionary, he goes back to his home village. He shares all the changes that have happened to them. He shows his hands and he shows his arms and he shows the change that has occurred because of physical surgery. He talks about the spiritual surgery that occurred in his heart. That night, Sudan went to bed, laying on his hut floor, reading his Bible next to his oil lamp. And he fell asleep. What woke him up in the night was nothing other than smell. The smell of some stench that he wasn't used to. And as he woke up and came out of his slumber, he realized that that stench was literally his skin burning against the oil lamp. He had fallen asleep. What Dr. Brand had found out is what leprosy does more than anything else is it takes away the feeling and knowing of pain. He was devastated. His whole arm was charred and scarred. The next night he went to sleep again, same hut, same mat, same floor. And when he woke up in the morning, Sudan looked on his clothes. And on his clothes, he saw sprinkles of blood and flesh. And he looked at his arms and his hands. And in the night, rats had come in and eaten away the flesh on his hands and his arms. When he went back to Dr. Brand, he said this statement that radically changed Dr. Brand's approach an understanding of leprosy. Sudan said to him, "How can I be free without pain?" Dr. Brand then did some research and he wrote a book called The Gift of Pain. And he talked about the reality that when we suffer, but when we no longer respond to pain, feeling, physical, emotional, mental, spiritual pain, sin, when we no longer respond to that, the consequences of that inactivity and that ineffective response can cause more of a serious damage than the actual disability itself. And so he understood and he realized. And then he wrote another book called The Gift of Pain That Nobody Wants. And he acknowledged in the reality and the truth that in this, he identified three ways that we deal with pain. And in this book talking about the gift of pain, he said there's three things. The first thing we deal when we look with pain is that pain is so overwhelming that in our lives, we just become numb to it. It just is overwhelming. The second way we deal with pain is that we seek to alleviate it. We seek to look at different artificial means. There's a lot of ways that we deal with pain artificially. Now, the most common ones are known as addictions. But there are other ways that we deal with pain artificially. Some people have a work ethic, that they work all the time and they work, everything that they do has a work ethic attached to it and it's hard work, but yet sometimes that alleviates pain. There's all different kinds of ways to do it. And then the third way he talked about alleviating pain was the idea that we just simply become used to it. And when we become used to it, we turn insensitive to pain. And so this morning, as we're ending up this series on Follow Me, we want to look at a passage of Scripture, and we want to look at an area where how did Jesus deal with pain? How did he deal with betrayal? How did he deal with failure? Because I think all of us in this room can relate to one aspect of pain, and that would be the pain of failure. When we have failed someone who we've loved, or we have failed someone in life, we all can understand that failure and that pain that comes alongside of that failure. Several weeks ago in our series, we talked about that one of the inhibiting factors of a hindrance of following Christ was fear. This morning, we want to look at the idea that it's not just fear, but this morning, it's pain. It's the reality of pain, whether it's self-imposed, whether it's caused by somebody else, whether it's pain by a failure of circumstances you have no control over. The inability to properly handle and deal with pain and its reality in our life is one of the greatest hindrances to following Jesus Christ. You might remember this quote that we've had up by Joe Stoll, kind of a theme quote. And we've talked about thinking of ourselves as followers keeps our focus on Christ and holds us accountable for how we live. If the focus is on our failure, or if the focus is on our pain, then our main thought is how to stop the pain rather than allowing it to draw us closer in our spiritual depth and awareness of who God is and following Christ. Now understand this about following. Following is a journey. It's not a destination. Now, following leads to a destination, but to follow Christ is not a destination. It is a journey. It is a path. And on that journey and on that path, we will fail. We will make mistakes. We will struggle. Now, the other thing I want to point out before we enter into the Scriptures is the idea of what kind of pain we're talking about. What kind of pain is it that actually works for us? What kind of pain is it that actually challenges us? And without that kind of pain, we would really struggle in life. I am not talking about self-inflicted pain. One of the most common causes among young people today is cutting. That is not the pain that God says you need to inflict upon yourself to understand the reality of the depth of struggle. Some of you have even noted that in this graphic that we've used, this whole series, we have an individual kind of standing on a building overlooking the city. And the whole context of that was to overlook the city and seeing the city in front of him. And God is saying, follow me into the city and challenge the city and be a light and a hope and an assault to the world that you're called into. And so this person is overlooking where God is calling him. And some of you have noted, but you know, it could also be as if a person is standing on the edge of a building contemplating suicide. Suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary pain. It's not what we're talking about this morning. We're talking about a different kind of pain and failure. In those particular instances that I just met, you have to get to the core issue. And the core issue in most cases will always be fear. What am I afraid of? How is fear driving me? And fear drives this particular pain as well. Why don't you take your Bibles and turn to the book of John, chapter 18. John, chapter 18. On the pew Bible in front of you, it's page 1049. And I understand that last week I gave you the wrong number. So for some of you that were confused and ended up in Malachi or somewhere like that. But I got the right number down, so you're good to go. And thank you, Bill Velting, for your 90th birthday. That's one way to ensure that the sermon does not go overtime. Making sure everybody gets a chance to celebrate with Bill and his Costco cakes. And John chapter 18, and Cameron's right, we do live and breathe cake. John chapter 18. And in John chapter 18, you look at this one verse, and this is really interesting, so follow with me. Let's look at John chapter 18, verse 1. When he had finished praying. Now that prayer is the entire chapter before that, 17. It is the only time that it's recorded. And so when John is saying, when he had finished praying, it's that whole entire chapter 17 previous. Jesus left with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley. On the other side, there was an olive grove, and he and his disciples went to it. Now, let's pause for a second, because this is really interesting. In one verse, John, in one verse, writes what the other Gospels, which we call the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke are called that because they are very similar. They are much the same. John, on the other hand, was completely different. 90% of what John writes is totally different than the other three. It's fascinating to look at this one verse John writes is a verse that in the other Gospels, over 125 verses are used to record the events that John just uses one verse for. Now keep in mind, why is that? Well, keep in mind that the theme of John is dealing with Jesus Christ, the Son of God. The theme of John is that Jesus Christ, God, becomes flesh, dwells among us, lives among us. He is God in human flesh. He brings the fullness of grace and truth. He relates and he wants to deal with our life. He brings salvation into our life, not just as an entry point to eternity with God, but as an entry point to life everlasting on earth. And so John's whole focus is on the deity of Christ, the reality of Christ entering into our lives. That's what he's focusing on. That's what he chooses to look at. Most scholars would agree that John was the last writer of the New Testament literature. The last book he wrote was roughly around 90 AD. All the other disciples, all the other writers were gone and dead. And John writes the final. The Gospel of John is written after the other three Gospels. It's almost as if when John writes, think about it this way. When you write a conclusion, you're almost summarizing everything that you've read before and you're drawing everybody's attention into, okay, this is the final conclusion. These are the last things I want you to absolutely remember about this entire New Testament John writes in the Gospel of John. And he gives us this culminated picture of who Jesus Christ is. So in our minds, we are thinking about the reality of Jesus Christ. We're thinking about his emphasis. We're thinking about the conclusion. John does not talk about the calling of the disciples. He doesn't talk about Jesus walking around saying, follow me, follow me. He doesn't talk about that. John writes instead the great I am passages. I am the bread of life. I am the Good Shepherd. I am the way. I am the truth. I am the life. I am the great physician. You see, John writes about that in perspective to give us a view of Jesus Christ entering into humanity as the Son of God. Fully God, fully human. Now, having said all of that, and having said that John 90% is totally different than the other three, here's the chapter that isn't. Here's the chapter that all four Gospels describe and deal with. And it happens to deal with Peter, and it happens to deal with Peter's failure and Peter's betrayal. So John chapter 18, verse 1, when he had finished praying that great garden prayer of agony, you progress now from that into what most people know as the great betrayals. And notice what John chooses to focus on when he is looking at in verse 15. Simon Peter and another disciple were following Jesus. These narratives are not necessarily found in the other Gospels in its entirety, although they're there in a general sense. But notice the specifics. Simon Peter and another disciple were following Jesus because this disciple was known to the high priest. He went with Jesus into the high priest's courtyard. So, the truth of the matter is, and most would look at this and say that this other disciple is John himself. Now, somehow, some way, John was known to the high priest's courtyard. Some think he was known because there were distant relatives that were connected. And so John was aware of, and John needs to notice. Notice what he focuses on. He focuses, first of all, on his relationship, This other disciple, he knew the high priest. He had access to the inner courtyard. He went with Jesus into that inner courtyard. Jesus was not alone going into that. He had one of his followers with me. John was known as a follower of Jesus Christ. That's really important to keep in your mind now. John was known. He was not a stranger. He was not some person that was mysterious to those in that courtyard. He was known as a follower of Jesus Christ. Now look at verse 16. But Peter had to wait outside the door. The other disciple, who was known to the high priest, so he says it again. Okay, so in case you didn't get it the first time, let me tell you, they knew me. They knew who I was. Came back, spoke to the girl on duty there. So there was a woman who was on a security detail and brought Peter in. Now follow what's happening here. John comes back. He is known to the court as a follower of Jesus. He's not a stranger. He comes back. He tells the girl, hey, Peter's okay. He's with me. I don't know if you've ever had that experience or that feeling where you know somebody who's like, woo, way up there, and you go to maybe a concert or something, and they know you, and they recognize you, and they say, hey, why don't you come backstage with me, and you feel like, whoa, I'm so cool, and they know me, and I'm known by them, and I walk past all the crowds of everybody that knows me. It's like being a senior in high school. Now, I don't know. I know seniors don't do that, and we have a lot of graduates, but when I was a senior in high school, we had a lot of privileges. One of the privileges that was an awesome privilege was we always, by flashing the senior ring, could go to the front of the lunch line. That's impressive. I mean, seriously, think about how powerful and important that was. I could walk in front of freshmen. I could walk in front of sophomores. I can walk in front of juniors that were smarter, bigger, better looking. And I got in front. And I could take someone I knew with me. That was the privilege of being a senior. Now, unfortunately, my sister was a sophomore I never took with me, and so to this day, she holds that against me. But here's John. He comes back to the courtyard. He says to the girl, I know this guy. He's okay. He can come in with me. Now, check the girl out here. It's almost as if she knows he's a follower of Christ. Remember, you don't ever ask a question you already know the answer to, okay? I don't think there's any doubt in her mind she knew who Peter was. No question about it. But check out what she says to him. You're not one of his disciples, are you? Very almost attack-oriented, right? You're not one of them, are you? Now think about it for a moment. John is known to the high priest. John's already come in. John's come back. Peter, it's okay. You can come in. There's not an issue here. You can enter into where Jesus is being held. You can come and join him in his potential misery. You can come with us. But look what happens. Now, it's possible, you know, keep this in mind, too. Peter just chopped off an ear of a guy, too, okay? And even though Jesus stuck the ear of Malchus back on, Peter's probably feeling a little bit guilty about it, or maybe he's thinking, there's some people that are going to be really ticked off at me, or maybe they think I'll go off in a violent binge again. I don't know. So Peter's got all this stuff going on. But the bottom line is, the girl says to him, hey, you're not one of his disciples, are you? And he replies, I am not. Just blurts it out. But he didn't have to do that. He didn't have to deny it. She already knew who he was. John already confirmed who he was. John had already secured permission for Peter to enter in. But Peter still denies. Peter still holds back. And then look at verse 18. It was cold, and the servants and officials stood around a fire they had made to keep warm. Peter also was standing with them, warming himself. It was cold. That phrase, around a fire, in the original language, it is only used twice. It's the word for charcoal. Grill. It's the first time grill, charcoal, is in the Bible. There's only two times that it's mentioned. Peter's warming himself around here. He's working through the fears and the struggles, and he understands that first betrayal and probably doesn't register into his mind until we get to verse 25. And then when we get to verse 25, it starts to click into Peter's mind. And in verse 25, as Simon Peter stood warming himself by that first grill, he was asked, "You're not one of his disciples, are you?" Again, see the tone, see the accusation. He denied it, saying, "I am not one of the high priest's servants." Now, this is getting pretty intense. A relative of the man whose ear Peter cut off. This guy's got to be really not too thrilled. He says, "Didn't I see you with him in the olive grove? Not to mention, I saw you chop off my cousin's ear. But weren't you there with him? I saw you with him." And again, Peter denied it. And at that moment, a rooster began to crow. Luke, the doctor, tells us that at that moment, Jesus was also in the courtyard, turned and looked at Peter. Peter saw him. The moment he said, "Well, I don't know you," Jesus saw and heard, and there was a connection. Have you heard of the sovereignty of God today? Have you heard the reality that Jesus Christ is omniscient? He is omnipresent. Have you heard the reality that his eyes are always seeking and looking and always desiring a connection? Always. Luke says, "Hey, Jesus turned and looked right at Peter." Matthew tells us that Peter went out and wept bitterly. And that word bitterly in the original language is the most intense emotional outburst and anguish, an expression for pain and remorse. He wept bitterly. And what do we know of Peter after that? Nothing. We don't hear about him in the intermeeting day. We don't hear about him at the crucifixion. We don't hear about him in between. We don't hear about Peter. We don't know what he did. We don't know where he went. But I guess he would probably do what we would do. When we blow it big time, we do not want to be around people. We do not want to be around people, especially the ones who know us best. Sin separates us from God, and sin separates us from people around us. Sin separates and isolates us from God's people. It isolates us. We don't want to necessarily even come to a church because we're thinking people are going to know, people understand, and people are looking at me, and people are judging me, and people are like, "Oh, what happened? I heard about this. I read about this, and all these things are going on, and people don't even..." So it's better to just stay away, and that's what Peter probably did. He stayed away. And so Dr. Brand's options began to become Peter's reality. He had to have felt alone. He had to have felt the intense betrayal and the question, why? Why did I do that? Have you been there? God, why? I've prayed about this. I have begged you. Why did I do that? I can't believe it. Again, that remorse, that failure, that pain. Peter walks away. Someone once said that failure is an event, not a destiny. And the reality of that whole context is to understand the truth of that. Winston Churchill said, "Success is not final. Failure is not fatal. It is the courage to continue that counts." You see, it's not the failure that ruins us. It's not the failure that distorts grace. It's what happens next that truly matters. It doesn't mean it's all over. Failure does not mean you cannot move on. It just means you have some real painful lessons you're going to have to learn. Failure doesn't mean that you need to give up. Failure doesn't mean that it's hopeless. It just simply means that you have to change your focus. Your focus is on yourself. Your focus is on your own inept response. It means change your focus. It means to elevate. It means to look across the courtyard and look into the eyes of Jesus Christ. The writer of Hebrews says, "Consider him who endured the cross, despising the shame. There is no one in the history of humanity that has experienced pain or failure more than the person of Jesus Christ. Consider him. Look into his eyes. Doesn't mean you should give up. Jesus Christ sees you. He knows you. He knows your heart. He died for you. He was buried for you. He rose again for you. That's the depth of his love. And as he looks across the courtyard every single day and asks the question, why? John, why? Look at me. See me. That's the focus. You know, this isn't part of our talk today, but I'll just throw it in free because you all like free stuff. What's really cool is to note something here. When Peter failed to follow Christ, when he failed to follow Christ and was deviated off of that path, Christ followed him and found him and brought him back. See, because when we read about Peter next, is at the resurrection. Luke tells us the Lord has risen and has appeared to Simon Peter. Paul even goes further. And Paul tells us that the core of the gospel is that Jesus was crucified, he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures, and that he appeared to Peter and then to the other disciples. Isn't that cool? Jesus and Peter, one-on-one, just the two of them, had to deal with some issues before Jesus went on to all the rest of the disciples. Jesus took the time. He followed Peter. How intense is that? Jesus met with Peter one-on-one. That's incredible grace. There was no public humiliation. Peter denied Christ, but Christ goes after Peter. And he goes to Peter. He doesn't force him to make the first move, but he comes to Peter full of grace and truth. You know, in our lives, we get really smug, don't we? They need to come to me. That person's wronged me. They have to come. And I'll wait until they come and ask me for forgiveness. And then I'll decide whether I'm going to give them forgiveness or not. Because after all, I'm the one that's wronged. Really? So how's that working for you? You see, Jesus followed and moved. Peter. Who in your life is Peter? Horribly scarred. Horribly full of pain. Who in your life is that one you need to extend grace and truth to? But you know, even after that, it wasn't over. Go to John chapter 21. Even after that, so Jesus meets Peter by himself at the resurrection. They have a conversation, not recorded, but they have a conversation, but it's not over. And only John, again, is the only one that writes about this encounter in John 21. So again, what's John doing? He's bringing Jesus Christ, the Son of God, into a personal, interactive relationship with humanity. This is how he is full of grace and truth. This is how Jesus Christ is fully God and fully man, intertwined. He comes together. John is showing us. Here's how he does it. So in John chapter 21, and look at verse 3. I'm going out to fish, Simon Peter told him. Now, this is after the resurrection. This is after the upper room. This is after all kinds of confusion. The guys still aren't sure what's going on. There's still uncertainty. And Peter and basically five other guys say, you know what? We're just going to go back to fishing. Go back to the way it was. Default mode. You ever messed up on your computer? Windows has the what? Restore back to a certain part, right? So you mess up and you think, oh man, I can restore back 3 months. I can go back to where it was 3 months ago. Now you realize you're missing all that in between, but that's okay. At least I get back to here where I know things are at. That was Peter and the apostles. They were saying, we're going to go back to what we know best. What do we know best? We know best fishing. That's who we are. That's who we'll always be. Jesus tried to pull us out of it. He tried to make us fishers of men. But you know what? I can't do this. I can't do this anymore. I'm going back to the way it was. I'm going back to my default lifestyle. I'm going back to the default parts that I know so well because I'm in control of it and I know what's happening. And that's what these guys did. They went back fishing, and you go on in verse 3, Simon Peter told them, and they said, here's the power of influence. Here's the power of Peter's leadership. Remember, he was the oldest of all of them. And they said, okay, we're going to go with you. We'll go with you. And so they go. And they go out. And it's evening. And all evening long, they fish. And what happens? And this is probably the most profound part of the New Testament that I have always loved. So they went out, got into the boat. But that night, they caught nothing. Default mode is extended emptiness and extended failure. It gets you nothing to go back to the way it was. It may create temporary stability, but it gets you nothing. And in the morning, some guy on the shore, they didn't really know who it was, even though I suspect he's only a football field away from where Jesus was, calls out and said, hey, throw out your nets on this side of the boat and you'll get a lot of fish. You know, I have a question for you. If Jesus was watching these guys for so long, why didn't he tell them right away? Why didn't he tell them that night before? Maybe he wasn't there, but I think he kind of was in a position. He'd been building a fire. He already had fish, so he got them from somewhere. Why didn't he tell them? Why did he allow these guys to struggle for so long? Well, here's the key. It was necessary for them to struggle to get to the eventual success. It was necessary for them to find emptiness and failure in default mode to finally begin to convict them and to challenge them. You know what? I need something more, something better. And you know what's even more cool about it? Here's how detailed is the Bible. This is one of the small, minute ways that you know the Bible is not just this mythological book of stories. When the Bible lists that they caught later on in verse 11, they caught 153 fish. And not just 153 fish, but big fish, great fish. You see, there's specifics to what God is doing here. And the clarity of this is what God and Jesus are trying to teach Peter and the disciples is that you fail, but you fail because you find yourself in me. The Microsoft founder Bill Gates once said that success is a lousy teacher. It makes smart people think they can't lose. That's what they were doing out there. They needed to fail. They needed to understand failure so they could understand dependence even more. Isn't that how you teach your kids to ride a bike? I mean, I don't know. I took the training wheels off my son's bike a lot earlier than was supposed to. He fell a lot. But it was so cool for him to say, Dad, can you help me? So you help him up, put him on his way, goes, falls over. Got to fight his way, find his way back up. You see, failure teaches you reliance, but learning to deal with things on your own, that's proper. But ultimately, learning to understand the value and the dependence on God is even more so. And what God is saying, what Jesus is saying, Peter, you're going to obey me even when it doesn't make sense. So how do we deal with failure? How do we look at failure? Well, the first thing to deal with failure, and this is on your note page, is we need to learn to let go. Dealing with failure is learning to let go. We're learning to let go. That's what Peter had to let go of that default mode, going back to the way it was. He had to change. He had to challenge himself in dealing with failure and pain. Look down at verse 9 of chapter 21. When they had landed, they saw a fire of burning coals there with fish on it and some bread. There's your second grill. It's only the second time the word for charcoal is found in the New Testament. So in that reality, it is the same word, the same context. In that reality, the first one was Peter was cold and miserable and standing around the fire to just get warm. In the second grill, he's standing and waiting to be fed. By who? Jesus Christ. By one grill, he says, I don't know the man. By the second grill, he says, Lord, you know I love you. By the first grill, he denies Jesus Christ. By that second grill, Jesus Christ accepts and restores him. And look at verse 10. I love this verse. Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish you caught. Now, there's this concept in Christianity. For some people, it's just to, well, letting go means I just sit back in my easy chair and I just put my foot up and I can't because it won't reach. And God, you'll just take care of things for me. I'll just sit back and, you know, God, you'll just work it out. I'm confident in that. And no, that's not Christianity. Jesus had fish for them, but he wanted more. And he said, bring some of the stuff you caught. What's he saying to them by that? What is he saying to us? He's saying, bring who you are to me, and together, your life experiences, your pain, your failure together, we can make something out of it. We can make some growth out of it. We can bring some truth to that. We can bring some things. And so God's power and our willingness to obey combined bring dynamic and great victory. Romans chapter 8, God's spirit and my spirit combined together declare that we're the children of God. That's what Jesus is saying, okay, bring the fish. Bring the fish to you. The next series that we're going to be doing in the summer is a series called Gifted. We're going to start that in a couple of weeks on 1 Corinthians 12. We're going to talk about spiritual gifts, and we're going to talk about abilities that God wants to use to align to bring them together. Look at verse 15. So they go, they bring the fish, and in verse 15 we have these classic, we're not going to narrate the whole thing, but when they had finished eating, Jesus said to Peter, Simon, son of John, do you truly love me? Notice the next three words and say them out loud with me. More than these. Who's he talking about? The Bible doesn't tell us that Peter and Jesus went off to some secure. They're just sitting there. Do you love me more than these? Who? Other disciples. Why would he say that to Peter? Because Peter, in front of the other disciples, said, Lord, even though all of them will betray you, I won't. In front of them, Jesus says, Peter, do you love me? Even more than these guys? Because remember what you said earlier. The very disciples that Peter bragged about, Jesus said, hey, do you love me? And here's Peter's response in declaring, I love you. He doesn't compare it to anyone else. He's learned. And look at what Jesus doesn't do. Jesus does not try to lay a big guilt trip on him. Jesus doesn't try to say, Peter, you promised me that you would obey me. You promised me you wouldn't be deceptive. And look what you did. You promised not to do it again. And Peter, no, Jesus doesn't ask that. He simply says, he focuses on a response that Peter actually has more control over. And this is something to remember. You have more control over your response of saying, Jesus, I love you, than you do dealing with the problems and failures in your life. You have a greater choice to say, I choose to follow and seek Jesus Christ, than the choice and choosing to give up whatever failure, pain, suffering is in your life. Changes their focus. Peter, do you love me? Peter had to see the seriousness of his sin. He had to be confronted with failure. And until we face that truth and the pain about ourselves, we can never be free. Someone once said that, yeah, the truth will set you free, but it will hurt you first. And after that third time of asking in verse 17, Peter said this. He said, Lord, you know all things. And that brings us to that last step. See, where Peter had to come to is he had to come to this idea that it's humbling, but it's healing. It's humbling to healing to be honest about self-confidence. Peter said, Lord, you know my heart. Seek me and know me. Kind of like the psalmist. Okay, God, you know who I am. Look inside me, you'll know. There's a humility there. There's a humbleness there. Lord, you look into my heart. You know, I might not even trust myself, but my trust is in the fact that you, Jesus Christ, you know my heart. And that's a painful admission. And that painful admission changed his life. And notice in verse 18 and 19. I tell you the truth, when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go. Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said to him, follow me. Follow me. He redeems him back to the path. Erwin Lutzer said this, God is able to forget the past. Why can't we? He throws our sins into the depth of the sea and he puts up a sign on the shore which reads, no fishing. No fishing means dropped nets. And here's the final great irony to Peter's pain and failure, and for every one of us here. Here's the truth of the reality of what happens to this. Jesus believed in Peter more than Peter believed in himself. And every one of you and every one of me this morning can put yourself right in that statement. Jesus Christ believes in you, John, more than you will ever believe in yourself. The issue is not how much do I believe in myself. The issue is how much do I believe in a Savior who loves me and gave himself for me, who knows me better than I know myself, and he still loves me full of grace and truth. That's the reality. That's what every single one of you can do. And the truth of the matter is we all have a bit of Peter in us. We fall again, we fail again. But God knows our hearts. There's a real popular poem on social media. Maybe you've seen it. God said, and God said, if you never felt pain, then how would you know that I'm a healer? If you never had a trial, how could you call yourself an overcomer? If you never felt sadness, then how could you know that I'm a comforter? If you never made a mistake, then how would you know that I'm forgiving? If you never were broken, then how would you know I can make you whole? If you never had a problem, then how can you know that I can solve them? If I never corrected you, then how would you know that I love you? If your life was perfect, then what would you need me for? As our praise team comes out and leads us in a final closing song, I want to challenge you to think about something. If you were never meant to follow, God says, why did I send my son to lead you to the cross? If you were never meant to follow, then why did God send his son to lead me to the cross? And this morning, there may be some of you here, and maybe you've attended for weeks, I don't know. But in your heart, you know failure in the deepest core. How do you not know that God is not calling you, leading you to the cross? Maybe you've never come to the point where you've said, I'm lost, I'm empty, I can't do it on my own. I need a Savior. I need that person that built that fire. I need that person that loves me so much that he gave himself for me. That's who I need. That's you this morning. I'll be down here in the front where prayer warriors will pray for you. Maybe there's a net you need to drop. Maybe there's something you need to bring down and just say, I need to drop this right now. I need to lay it at the cross. When we sing, lead me to the cross, it's more than just personal salvation. It's salvation for your person. So stand together with us. Keep in mind, if you are not made to follow, then why would God send his son to lead me to the cross?